Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
10 hours on my feet, traffic, noise, everybody needs something from me. My head is spinning. I just need the world to stop for 1 second. But then I get home, shoes off, phone out, and I open Modo Casino. Hundreds of slots, classic table games. It's my instant reset. The variety I want in the quiet I need.
Modo Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Modo.us for more details. Download the Modo Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Modo Casino. America's social casino.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
All right, we got stuff to talk about in the Nancy Guthrie case. Some new interesting things have taken place. The opening hours of this case are the ones that stretch where the facts are actually locked, not theories, not leaks, but machine timestamps and a 911 log that is now out there. A camera goes dark at 1:47 in the morning. A pacemaker loses its signal at 2:28. Later that day, after a call that Nancy had missed church, family walks into her home and is on the phone with 911 within 7 minutes. What those first hours now show us, what the records prove, what's still being kept from the public, and what a fast by-the-book start says about a case that's frozen ever since is worth slowing all the way down on. And that's what we're going to be doing today. Jennifer Coffin-Daffer, retired FBI special agent, joining myself, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Jen, let's start with what we know about the time. The family, the record puts them in the house at 11:56. They're on the phone with 911 by 12:03. So they get in. Where's mom? Let's look around. I mean, it's a very reasonable, oh God, what the hell's going on? Just within 10 minutes about of them calling 911 once they get to the house. When you're looking at this from an investigative standpoint, what does it tell you about the speed of the call? What kind of a tell is that about that family that's in distress knowing mom is not there?
Well, it tells me that I believe they went in through the garage because that's how they let her in, and it seemed like that was their usual pattern. They went in, and again, mom, where are you? Mom, got the call. You look around, and these frames are not easy. This is not just a two-bedroom, two-bath ranch. This is a larger, spread-out house on a large property. So from there, you're going to always go in and check her guest house just in case she went in there, heard something, had to get something out of there. Obviously, you're looking in the pool and you're looking at all rooms. And when you look at this time frame, that pretty much sets up about 7 minutes likely to accomplish all of that. And to me, when they then went out that front door and looked from the front door vantage and saw the blood, 911, oh my God, she's gone.
Yeah, I mean, that's the moment that I'm sure their hearts probably sunk. I mean, at first, I imagine anything could be going through your head. You know, did she get picked up somewhere? Did she go for a walk? She couldn't go for a walk. Her cane's right here. All these things running through their minds in that sheer moment of panic. And then they see the blood on that porch. The 911 call is the one that started everything. And all of this time later, the public still hasn't heard a second of the 911 call yet. It's being held back, they say, for the investigation itself. But you've been on the inside of calls like that. When the recording that kicked off this whole case still stays locked up for this long and we still don't have her, well, I guess what's being protected? Why can't we hear the 911 call?
They're always going to protect that call in a case like this. And they did the same thing in the Idaho 4 case. We never heard that call until well into the adjudication of that case. True. So they're going to follow that. There's no reason. The public doesn't need to know. The clues with the torch dies loose. And if by a vehicle. That's what the public can help with. They're not going to release anything unless the public can provide help. Other than that, they don't care that the public doesn't.
Yeah, I'm really curious about the 911 call, Jen, because only when we started looking at this, like, oh my gosh, we haven't had the 911 call, especially since 911 calls, as you know, are so telling, because you can really predict whether someone has involvement or not involvement a lot of times, not all times, but a lot of times from a 911 call. I would think if they're looking to clear family and show how they're not involved, just how they make that 911 call could really dispel a lot of those conspiracy theories on it, I would think. Any thoughts on that?
So I find it interesting, Robin, that in so many cases, no matter what the person says on the 911 call, it's going to be scrutinized. If they're panic and go crazy, they say, oh my gosh, it's an act. If they are calm, they say, see, they don't even care that she's missing. So to me, there's no upside if I'm an investigator to release the call, because I think it makes the dogs come out against the family no matter what was said, especially when the dogs were already released on the family.
And unless you actually know 911 calls and you can see it really readily, and to help tamp those people down. I mean, so when I worked at Quantico, we had an amazing woman. I don't know if you remember Sue Adams. She used to teach at Quantico at the FBI Academy a lot for many years. She did a great research study with another law enforcement professional years ago, and they actually did the research on it, and they came up with a formula on 911 calls. I think that had about 90% accuracy being able to tell whether the caller was actually the perpetrator of the crime themselves. There's a lot of studies from the statement analysis. I know it doesn't help the general public at large, but hopefully maybe that's part of the see, that's why it would have helped if Nano said something to the effect of, we analyzed the 911 call. The BAU analyzed the 911 call. That was part of our way that we got rid of the family as suspects, rather than just say, no, they're not considered anymore.
Yeah, no, they could have listed so many things. For instance, the poll results. They could have talked about the digital trail. They could have talked about all the car information that disclosed that, listen, every Saturday night they go back and forth this way. Uber's called and then, you know, he drops her off. They could have done so much, but I think, you know how law enforcement is. They're going to say the bare minimum they can to get the point across, and they're not going to give up much about what they did or didn't do.
It's not too late. Why don't they do it now?
Yeah, no kidding.
It would help Nanos. But Nanos is being quiet, right? I think Nanos has like learned his lesson. Somebody's gotten through to him. Just shut up. You know, he finally is in the clear, if you will. Nobody can get rid of him. I don't think the recall vote, that's the only thing left outstanding, and I don't think that's going to work. So he's kind of in the clear. So he's gone turtle. You know?
I mean, I'm wondering about, you know, because of, you know, the dogs that were unleashed on the family immediately. And then Nanos, a little while after, makes it somewhat generic. And look, I'm stating this as I don't believe the family's involved, but I'm stating this in a perspective of, okay, he makes his statement of they're cleared as generically as he does. And that almost like further enrages the conspiracy theories out there. Why not come out and say, okay, yeah, I gave you the generic version, but here's why I've cleared them. This, and this. This is the evidence. We have it now. I should have released it earlier. I did not. It helps him. It clears up his shortcomings, and it helps the family. If they have absolutely nothing here to hide, and I don't think they do, it further solidifies their story as well and their alibi. I guess why not at this point come out with more solid, you know, evidence-based decision-making background on some of these, you know, words that he's thrown into the ether? If they're there, why are they there? I believe there's probably a reason for it, but why not shut down the noise, I guess, at this point? Or do they just not care about the noise? Because I know the family certainly cares about the noise around this.
I think because it'll cause more noise. It's opening Pandora's box.
Yeah.
So they polygraph. Okay, now we want to see them. When were they polygraphed?
Yeah.
What happened? Polygraph. Okay, let's see the digital evidence. You've already disclosed that it's there. So what's it going to hurt to let us know about it? So I think it just opens Pandora's box, and that's why they're not going to touch it.
Makes sense.
I get that. It's a shame, you know, but there are a lot of, you know, I mean, we're critical thinkers on our show. It would help the critical thinkers that have actually critically thought through the family not being involved. It would help tamp down the nutters, because you're always going to have nutters. There's always going to be people that are conspiracy theorists. And without a little bit, granted, I'm not arguing it because I totally get it. It opens up Pandora's box again, but then it gets more attention on the case again. And then you have critical thinking people out here that are saying, hey, look, because boom, 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 look over here, here, here. I don't know.
True. Yeah. I mean, it's a battle of feelings at this point, but there's obviously some, you know, real repercussions for how things were handled early on in this. And I'm not just speaking from the Nano standpoint. The night itself left a trail. Her camera dies at 147, motion trips at 212. Her pacemaker drops off at 228. These are actual timestamps that we now have. When you line those three up in that order, Jen, I mean, what stands out to you? Is there anything chilling about the way that that lays out? How does that read to you?
Well, a couple of things. One of the things is, let's start with the 212 in the middle. At the 212 where a person is seen, right? They can't make anything out, but they believe it's a person. And remember, that's another one of the spontaneous utterances of Nano's, right? Mm-hmm. He says, and he's like, oh, or it could be a pig or whatever, an animal. I think he says something like that. But yeah. I mean, clearly a person. And or else that wouldn't be on the timeline. And he wouldn't have made the spontaneous utterance anyway. So now we're at 212. Mope, porch guy, is not in any hurry that we've seen on camera. And I wouldn't believe that behavior would suddenly change at 212. So now he meanders over to the back. And now he's got to open a door. So he's got a brief door. We still don't know for sure whether a door was left open or whether it wasn't. But nevertheless, let's just say he has to breach it. If he has to breach it, that takes some time. I think I can breach a door that doesn't have a deadlock in probably under 2 minutes. So let's just say that he knows how to do that. He does it under 2 minutes. If it's a deadbolt, that's even more difficult. But now he's got the door breach. He gets it. That's a period of time. And there's only from 212 to 228 with the disconnection. Then he has to go in. And if he has studied her layout of her house, he could go pretty quickly there and make the assumption she's in the bedroom. Then he has to grab her, get her. I think that there is some violence used. And I say that because I truly believe that blood is expirated on the porch, which is typically a sign of internal bleeding.
Uh-huh.
And so I think he probably violently grabs her. And for somebody who is as frail as she is on blood thinners, I think that that probably caused some damage. And he grabs her. I think he puts her over the shoulder or in this stance where her head is a little bit closer to the ground. Uh-huh. And grabs her. Remember, she's over 150 pounds.
Yeah.
This is not an easy task if it's just him. The door, he has already got the camera off. He opens it from the inside, walks out with her. And that time frame pretty much comports.
So we're talking, I mean, how long are we talking here in terms of minutes of them getting into the house and getting her out when we're looking at this data that now is out there? What are we at?
16 minutes from the time. He is seen on the side of the house. Remember, porch guy in an injury. He mopes over there, goes to the back, looks around. I think I'll go in this door. For some reason, he props open the doors. I don't think those were propped up. And I know some people said, well, maybe she liked a breeze. My problem with that is she knows there's javelinas out there and wildlife. I mean, that's why she got the cameras.
A thought process might be too, like, I'm going to have to carry her, prop it open so it's open, but then go get her, then just don't shut the door when you leave. I don't know. I mean, that might be part of the thought process. Robin, what are your thoughts?
I'm just still thinking about trying to sling her over my shoulder with a backpack on at 150 pounds. That's, you know, I'm just thinking about the awkwardness of trying to do that. Like you're saying, Jen, or was he carrying in front of her and carrying 150 pounds like a sack? That's a large feat. I mean, that's a huge feat. I don't know how the guy kind of going to the point where a lot of people are saying this is well planned out because he's still at large. Yeah, kind of. But like this looks like if he's targeting her, getting her out of there was a real fatal flaw in how he's going to execute that. Like you said, I agree. I think he probably grabbed her quickly once they encountered each other. Her being frail, but frail at 150. I mean, that's with again that because again, think about this. That hefty backpack he on really jutted out from his back, and you're trying to get something over your shoulder, so she's not going to be draping down the back of his back. She's going to be sliding forward. I'm getting again. You're just kind of putting yourself in that situation. That's a hard carry.
Was that part of, I guess we got to go back to then, was taking Nancy the intent, or was Nancy being taken like an oh shit moment of, now I got to carry her out of here because she's part of the evidence because I got my DNA on her from whatever it may be, scratching or whatever. I don't know. I mean, because again, if you're thinking he's going into this to steal or to do something of that nature, he looks equipped for that. He doesn't necessarily look like he's equipped and ready to haul somebody out. That doesn't, I don't know that
unless
he'd go in.
To walk out.
Yeah, go into there with, I don't know. I've never done this. You guys have far more experience in worlds of this nature than me. But I don't know. It doesn't, I agree. It doesn't necessarily look like that was part of the plan. But again, nothing's necessarily stolen either, other than Nancy. So we're back at square one. What was the intent you're going in? Knowing what we see of this timeline, knowing how short this was, about 16 minutes or so from start to finish. Jen, where are you at this week with it? Do you think the intent was a wrench attack or just an intent to take Nancy, period? Or does this lean more into a surprise and they took Nancy out because, you know, she was basically part of the evidence?
I've been square for months on this. This was a ransom gone bad. That's it. Now, as far as who's pulling the strings on it, I'm definitely leaning toward a more organized wrench type attack in this type of a deal. But I have believed from the onset, not one thief I know goes in with a backpack like that. That's what you take empty to fill up with all the things you're going to steal. You ransack the place. You typically have more than one person. You don't this obscure place. I have never believed, not at one moment, that this was a home invasion or some thieves, that it all went south. Never believed that personally. I've always said the abduction was the point. And when they go in there and take her, I agree with Robin also based on the blood spatter. If she is slung over the shoulder, I think the mist and the spatter that would have come out from where she was bleeding, you would see those pockets of emptiness on the blood that drops. And you don't see that. You also don't see footprints, is why I think he did it solo. I don't think there were two people, at least at this point of it, because I think you would see footprints. And you would see that blood smudged and messed up. And that's why I think the family didn't go in the front. Because if you were going in the front, how often do you really look down?
Yeah.
You would have just walked up there in a hurry. But their modus operandi is always to go to that garage, seemingly, right? That's how she got in the night before. So I think that that was the oh crap moment. And I really believe, and this is how I've described it from the beginning, that it wasn't a fireman's carry. It was more of a cradled carry. And you're right, Robin, that he had to have tips for that.
So let's go down the road of your theory of targeted either by a group organization or him as an individual. In either event, because of the way he prepped himself, if he's solo in there, which it looks like we're agreeing he was solo in there, the intent was not to incapacitate her 100% because he wasn't prepared for incapacitation. He wasn't equipped for it. And if a group organization was behind this, they have reps in this. If this is something he's been doing before and it's a wrench attack, they have reps in this. And the reps would say, if your intent was to carry her out of there incapacitated, this is not the way it would have looked. So I definitely think that if that was the intent, the intent was to remove her from the house under her own motor skills, not to have to carry her out, because it makes no sense about how they did it whatsoever. Someone that had at least done it once before where they incapacitated the victim would not have done it that way.
I agree. And I also believe that these wrench, and we'll just keep going with that theory, meaning somebody organized that's making these decisions that initially targeted her and then got somebody to do this through payment, which is our Moat Porch guy. If that is the premise, these individuals are not, this could have been, and I think it was likely his first rodeo. You know, he's on the dark web getting picked out, and he wants to do it. He wants the money. He wants to be Rambo for a night. And it doesn't mean that he's good at what he's done, because you're right. He doesn't have the reps. He can't even figure out how to pull off the ring camera because his gloves are five sizes too big. You know, and then he has to get that and grip it and take both hands and you know, get that plant matter deposited deep into the holder.
Yeah.
So it was just waving it. A lot of people, again, that, you know, I know it's psychobabble that, you know, the ivy, like it meant something. I just don't think that's the case here. I think it was purposeful.
I don't see a world where the plant matter was pre-planned. Like, oh yeah, just go grab some plants and that'll work out great for whatever. It's like, yeah, that seemed to be a desperate move of like, they'll get some traction using this. Okay, do that. It doesn't seem to be the work of a super experienced. But and that's the weird thing with these wrench attacks is I've studied up on them too this week. It essentially doesn't matter. You know, who your idiots are, your mopes are that you're using, because if it all goes to hell, it's not going to be traced back to you anyhow. And you can just try it with another person next time. And there's a first time for everything for folks who want to sign up for missions like this. And again, this might be the first time for this guy. And this is what you got.
He was pretty fluid for a first time, though. So it might have been a first. So again, going down Jen's theory, if he's hired by someone as a mope, it wasn't his first time doing a B&E because he was fluid. That might have been his first attempt at this. Then it goes back to my question for you, Jen. So if the intent, if we're looking at behaviorally, we're looking at intent for a wrench attack, she's got to be alive, got to be conscious. And he wasn't prepared to have to be carrying her out. So her being incapacitated was not part of the plan. So then why remove her and not leave her?
Oh, I totally agree. But I don't think necessarily, I mean, she wasn't dead and he would have known that.
Right, right.
If she were dead, she couldn't expirate. So just because somebody isn't mobile enough, like you need them to be, the cane was left behind. We know that now for certain. I don't think she walked out on her own accord.
Definitely not.
Recently, though, a crime scene reconstructionist type person, they said she did, and that she was actually like crawling and was that close to the ground. I just don't believe that. I think he was like, we're getting out of here, grandma. I think it's likely she could have even been unconscious and that wasn't expected. I don't think she was dead.
Yeah. So if she's bleeding, and he had her crawl out of there, I think you'd have a DNA trail of something if she was doing it that way. Because I think any other bodily fluids coming off of her was being absorbed by him, whatever he was wearing. So to cover that his tracks unintentionally on the way out. It's the whole thing's crazy.
Another week and more questions than answers, really, on this. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue that part of the conversation right there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
I want to do something on this show that we haven't done on the Nancy Guthrie case yet. We're going to be walking through the entire thing from the night Nancy disappeared all the way to where this investigation stands in one piece, the whole timeline, every event, every development, every piece of evidence, every news beat, every chapter. And here's why I want to do this. The case is so much going on. So many separate developments, so many side stories, so many days it felt like turning points. And I think a lot of people, even people who've been following this case closely on this show, have started to lose the thread Where are we? What actually happened? What did the agencies do? What did they not do? What's been reported? What's been disputed? What's still open? So, you and I are going back to the start, beginning to now, so we can all see it together. We can build our own picture of where the case actually stands in your head with all the pieces in front of you. So that when the next development drops, and it will, you've got a full picture to weigh it against, a fresh picture. All there, all laid out in one piece, like only time can give us. Perspective. Your thoughts as we work through this in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. I'd love for you to weigh in. So here's what I want to be straight up about right up front. I'm not going to tell you what to think about any of this. I'm just going to walk you through every piece in order. There are sides on this case and theories and disputed facts and people I respect who read the same evidence in completely different ways. And I'm going to lay it out. You take it from there. Okay? This isn't going to be a here's what Tony thinks piece. Maybe I'll throw a little conjecture in there, but I will let you know when I do. Before we go back, here's where we are right now, because I think you need to feel where this case has landed before we walk through how it got here. Outside of the a newsroom in Tucson, the KVOA TV station, there's a big banner. Nancy's face is on it. Three words are underneath. Bring her home. Around the photo, there's hundreds of handwritten notes from strangers, people who never met Nancy, people who drove from Phoenix just to write something down and pin it up. The banner went up in the days after she vanished, and it's still there. The cameras that surrounded her house in February, I mean, a lot of them are gone. Reporters, gone. The country, the way the country always does, moved on. The banner didn't. 4 months in, that's where the case visually sits. A banner, notes from strangers, a missing 84-year-old grandmother whose name is still on the FBI's seeking information page. That is the picture. Now, let me walk you through how we got here. First, Nancy, because before this is a timeline, she is a person. And I want you to keep her in your head every step of the way through what we're about to walk through. Nancy's 84, mother of three. One of them is Savannah Guthrie. Yes, obviously from the Today Show. Before she was anybody's mother on television, Nancy raised a son with Down syndrome who outlived every prediction the doctors gave her. She had been a fixture of her Catalina Foothills neighborhood in Tucson for decades, kind of presence that pulled hundreds of people into a single church to pray for her when she disappeared. Nancy is a pacemaker. She has medication that she takes every single day for her heart. She has a hearing aid, and she takes it out at night. All three were left inside her house the night she was taken. Whoever was on her porch took Nancy and left the rest behind. That detail is one a lot of people in this case keep coming back to. I'll let that sit there too. So let me start where this starts. Saturday, January 31st. Nancy takes an Uber to her daughter Annie's house for dinner, a normal Saturday for a woman in her 80s. Around 9:48 p.m., a family member drives her home, garage opens, garage closes. Then come the three timestamps the case has been built around. 1:47 a.m., Nancy's doorbell camera disconnects. 2:12 a.m., the camera registers motion it can't save. 2:28 a.m., her pacemaker app disconnects from her phone. 41 minutes, that's the window between those anchor points. By the time her congregation noticed she wasn't in her pew, or virtual pew, if you will, the next morning, that window was already 8 hours closed. Now the response. Parishioners alert the family Sunday afternoon. The sheriff's department is at the house by Sunday night. And by Wednesday, Savannah and her siblings record their first video plea. Three adult children trying to keep their voices steady on camera, asking whoever has their mother to bring her home. Thursday, the FBI announces a $50,000 reward. And inside Nancy's home, deputies find what looked like a crime scene. Nancy's blood confirmed later by DNA on her own porch. The doorbell camera that was screwed into the wall, gone. Her phone, her wallet, and her medication still inside. And the country reacts. The tip line gets buried almost immediately. Inside the first 24 hours after authorities go public, more than 4,000 calls come in. 2 weeks in, the FBI is working through more than 18,000 tips. And by the end of February, more than 30,000. People want to help. The country wants to help. How the local agency processed that volume, that's been part of the conversation around this case ever since. That same week, the opportunists show up, and I want to deal with these people right here in this part of the timeline. So they're set aside, and we keep moving. A 42-year-old man in Hawthorne, California, named Derek Kalela, allegedly texts Nancy's daughter and son-in-law from a virtual phone number demanding Bitcoin. The FBI traces him through his email and IP address. Inside a week, he's arrested, charged federally, released on a 20-grand bond, and he has a federal date now in Tucson. At the same time, TMZ starts receiving messages from somebody else claiming inside knowledge of who took Nancy. Both the FBI and the family's representatives have publicly characterized these communications as separate from the actual investigation. Kalela is presumed innocent until his trial concludes. Whoever wrote those messages to TMZ has not, by any official statement made public, been linked to whoever was on Nancy's porch. So we keep walking through this timeline. File them in their own folder. Folder. Right there. By the end of the week, at least the end of week one, the case has a national audience. Nancy's blood on the porch, her abandoned medication, a missing camera, and the 41-minute window. What it doesn't have is a publicly identified suspect. That's the central gap. And that comes February 10th. There are a lot of people on this story I've been pointing to ever since. The FBI in Pima County release the doorbell footage. The public finally sees what the camera caught before it went dark. Man in a ski mask, gloves, a jacket, a holstered handgun on his hip, about 5'9", 5'10", average build, 25-liter Ozark Trail hiker pack on his back, a backpack the FBI specifies is sold exclusively at Walmart. He walks up to the door. He sees the camera. He reaches down, pulls a clump of weeds out of Nancy's own yard, and uses it to cover the lens. That clip set off a debate that hasn't stopped. Was this planned? Was the camera covering improvised on the spot? Or did he know it was there ahead of time? Was a masked figure there for Nancy specifically, or for the house? Different analysts have come down on different sides. The FBI has not publicly answered any of those questions. So when we mention this footage, all we can say is for sure is that's what the camera caught. In the days after the footage drops, deputies find discarded gloves about 2 miles from Nancy's house that resemble the pair in the video. They pull DNA off the gloves. And then, a beat that's gotten a lot of attention from legal analysts, the searchers themselves dropped 16 of their gloves on the ground during the canvas. The same area where the suspect's gloves were recovered is also an area where the searchers' gloves were recovered. How that affects the future evidence handling and chain of custody is something a legal analyst salivates over. The FBI doubles the reward to $100,000 and brings in its elite hostage rescue team. Neat. If there was a hostage to be rescued, the unit out of Quantico that handles high-stakes operations comes to Tucson. So let me give you a picture of what the search actually looks like at its peak, because this time sometimes gets lost in the noise. FBI agents canvassing roadways, washes, pull-offs, every gas station between Nancy's neighborhood and the major routes out of Tucson. Surveillance video pulled from neighbors' blocks in every direction. The Bureau working with Google to extract residual data from the back end of Nancy's camera, trying to recover anything the device may have caught before it disconnected. Search and rescue teams sweeping the desert. So many news crews and true crime followers gathering outside Nancy's house that deputies put up street barriers and manage the traffic. One beat from this part of the timeline I think a lot of people have already forgotten. The United Cajun Navy showed up. the volunteer search organization that mobilizes for natural disasters and missing persons cases, publicly stated they offered Sheriff Chris Nanos a full operation package. According to the group's vice president, Nanos did not respond. The sheriff has not publicly addressed that claim, and there's plenty of questions about the legitimacy of the Cajun Navy, or which version of it is wanting to help, and for what reasons. By late February, the FBI's command post, the one set up in Tucson in those first frantic days, moves to Phoenix. Bureau sources tell CBS that the time-sensitive on-the-ground work is done. Leads can be run from anywhere now. The federal energy on the scene, it starts to fade. The cameras start picking up. The crowds outside Nancy's house, they start thinning out. Okay, now we come to the part of the timeline that's run as a parallel story alongside the case itself. And I want to be careful here because there are people on both sides of it, and I'm not asking you to side with either. In late February, the Arizona Republic reports that Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos' publicly posted resume misstated his work history. He did not leave the El Paso Police Department in 1984. According to public records cited in the report, he resigned in 1982 in lieu of termination after a stretch that included multiple suspensions and allegations involving use of force, illegal gambling, habitual tardiness, insubordination, and dereliction of duties. His department updated the resume and called the discrepancy a clerical error. I'll let you read the report and the public records and form your own opinion. Not long after, Nanos tells the New York Times the case to find Nancy, it could take an hour from now, maybe weeks from now, or years from now. That word years landed hard with the Guthrie family. Family representatives responded publicly. The sheriff later clarified the remark. The exchange became a flashpoint in the public conversation around the case. A Republican congressional candidate named Daniel Buttigieg launched a recall. 120,000 signatures inside 120 days with the Guthrie case named as the last straw. The Pima County Board of Supervisors votes unanimously to compel Nanos to testify under oath on the resume, on retaliation allegations from his last election challenger, on the investigation itself. Some people on this case see all of that as a sideshow that has nothing to do with finding Nancy. Other people see it as the central story. That's a debate that's been running for months. I'm laying it out there for you. The reporting is the reporting. What you make of it is certainly your call. Then comes May 5th, a moment people in this story have been pointing to ever since. FBI Director Kash Patel goes on Sean Hannity's podcast and addresses on the record what has been whispered around Tucson for quite some time. Patel says the Pima County Sheriff's Department did not initially cooperate with the FBI in the way the Bureau expected. He says the Bureau could have helped sooner, particularly with DNA work. Nanos has publicly disputed how Patel characterized the relationship. So it's a big he said thing. So there's the on-record split, the director of the FBI on one side, the local sheriff on the other, each agency offering a different account of what happened during the days when the case was hottest. I don't have a way to adjudicate between them, and frankly, neither does anybody outside the investigation. That's the situation we're in. Around the same window, legal analysts, including a defense attorney quoted by Newsweek, have publicly flagged a series of complications around the evidence picture as the case has aged, mixed DNA, testing delays, the contaminated glove site, chain of custody questions. The conclusion those analysts have offered is that the longer the case goes without resolution, the more difficult any eventual prosecution might become. That's their analysis. Neither the FBI nor the Sheriff's Department have publicly responded to it, although it's really just kind of one of those facts of life. And then the case quiets. Savannah Guthrie returns to the Today Show in early April after a two-month leave. She spent in Arizona with her family. The family's reward climbs from $100,000 to $1 million. And as of the latest public update from authorities, no claim has come in. Now, $1 million is a lot of money. In a lot of high-profile abduction cases, somebody eventually calls a girlfriend, a roommate, a cellmate who heard somebody talk. And this one, by the agency's own statements, that call has not yet come. What that silence means, again, It's for you to decide. There are analysts who read it as evidence a suspect was acting alone. There are analysts who read it as evidence a suspect has people around him whose silence is being kept by something stronger than money. There are analysts who think the answer is something none of us have considered yet. The honest answer is nobody outside the investigation actually knows. By mid-May, Nanos confirmed to People magazine and an interviewer that his department is no longer communicating directly with the Guthrie family. The FBI is now the sole liaison. The same sheriff who told the Guthries in February he wasn't giving up by mid-May is not speaking with them directly at all. The 100-day mark passes. The sheriff's department puts out a statement. Scientific evidence processing, DNA analysis, digital media review, all of it ongoing. A few weeks later, after another silence, the department breaks in to say essentially the same thing. Still ongoing. So now let me put the whole board in front of you, where everything sits. As of where you and I are talking. Mixed DNA under analysis. Doorbell footage still under what the sheriff's department calls forensic review. The masked man on tape, not publicly identified. The $1 million reward sitting on a table with no legitimate claim. A federal trial coming for Derek Kalayla for the alleged Bitcoin demands, separate from whoever was on Nancy's porch. A sheriff facing a recall campaign and a board of supervisors investigation under oath. A family that, as of mid-May, is hearing from the FBI as the sole point of contact rather than from the local agency that handled the case from its start. That is the board. That is everything that has been reported, confirmed, or publicly stated of substance about the Nancy Guthrie case from January 31st to the moment you and I are talking about it. That's the timeline, beginning to now. Everything I've got, again, of substance. There's little tentacles all over. But again, we don't have 20 hours to discuss. We've already discussed them all. If you want to go back to the tentacles of this, look back in the last 5 months of videos and you will see all of the tentacles of this. This is your baseline if you're just trying to get caught up or have a bit of a palate cleanser as to what's going on here. Let's go back to that banner outside the newsroom in Tucson. KVOA. The handwritten notes from strangers, months of well wishes. Nobody has taken the banner down. Nobody's come home. Nancy went home from dinner with her family at 9:48 on a Saturday night. She wore a hearing aid she took out that night. She had medication she needed every day to keep her heart steady. She had a pacemaker that pinged for the last time at 2:28 in the morning. 4 months, more than 30,000 tips, the FBI's elite hostage rescue team on the ground in those first days with no hostage to rescue, $1 million reward sitting on the table, doorbell footage, the blood on the porch, the 41-minute window, the recall, the Board of Supervisors investigations, the Patel interview, the People magazine confirmation, the 100-day silence. That's what we know. What it adds up to, that is for the FBI and the Sheriff's Department and a future jury to determine. For you and me watching from the outside, holding on to every piece while we wait for the next one. Her name is Nancy Guthrie, not Savannah's mom, not the missing 84-year-old, not the woman from the Today Show story, Nancy Guthrie. If you haven't said her name out loud in a while, say it now. Because somewhere, somebody out there knows where. She is still waiting for somebody to come bring her home. Whether she's alive or not is another question. But she deserves answers and she deserves to be found. That's where it's at. So, if you've been trying to figure out where everything's at with the case and kind of get a baseline, I hope that helped you. Kind of helped me just put it all back into perspective, not going down this rabbit hole or that rabbit hole, because that seems to be a lot of what we're doing right now. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Will she be found? When will she be found? What do you think is happening? We'll continue that conversation there. Links are in the description. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part, guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spend on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part, guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Moto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino, because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.